Welcome to Limitless with Lisa Z, a podcast about how to move from inspiration to action and bring our dreams to life. I'm Lisa Zahia, and each week I'll release two podcasts, one where I walk you through action steps about how to make your dreams a reality, with another podcast in which I interview amazing changemakers from all over the world. This podcast isn't just for listening. Take notes and take action. Let's ignite and change the world together.
So excited. We've got a bit of a joint co-hosted podcast episode today. And so I'm joined by my beautiful friend, Lisa Zahia, all the way in Tobago in the Caribbean. And she has just shown me her beautiful view of her hotel room. And oh my gosh, Lisa and I have known each other for the last 2.5 years. And I had the absolute pleasure of hanging out with Lisa in New York City last year. Lisa's a, oh my goodness, a very accomplished business coach. She's worked with 6- and 7-figure entrepreneurs. She's spoken on stages around the world, has clients, recently finished a retreat in Egypt. But otherwise, I just affectionately know you as a beautiful friend and peer who is so full of wisdom. And I'm so excited to dive into our conversation today.
Me too. I always like to love to talk to you in Australia because I'm like, it's the future. The future is calling me. It's tomorrow.
I can't wait for you to come visit.
I know. I can't wait to come too. And yes, we've known each other for a while and a very long-term friendship and colleagues. And when I met you in New York, I was like, Ryan is tall. You know, because we only knew each other on Zoom for a long time.
I was very bitterly disappointed with my pick of Michelin star Mexican because that was very overrated.
Yeah. Yes, it was overrated and it was vegan.
Yes. Yeah, it was missing a few flavors.
It's just like, it's fine, but meat is better.
Absolutely. And Lisa, I think the thing that I really love is whenever we connect, some of the thoughts and the ideas that have floated through your head have often been things that I've been ruminating on in the months prior as well. And I would just love to hear, what are some of like the life lessons that you've actually been learning on your travels? You've been traveling now for like the last 2.5, 3 months?
7 months. Seven months.
Oh my goodness, the time's flown.
Yeah, I would say this is what I've been thinking about recently. One is it's about the people. Like, you know, we have all these, you and I were just talking about world conflict. We have all these ideas of like I think it's really dangerous anytime I say these people are this. You know, and it's really interesting because I spend a lot of time in Egypt and people always are like, are you safe? How's it going? Are you safe? Do you have to cover yourself? And then you go there and you have these amazing just connections with people. And it's about the human connection. So I've been thinking about that a lot. And it's really just about the people. Professionally, I think I'm getting further and further and further away from the like coaching machine and just focusing on my clients and how I can serve people. I just started a membership. But I'm like so disillusioned and disappointed with like the quick fix coaching marketing.
Now, that's interesting actually, because I think of your first point about humanizing people, because as soon as we meet people and we give them a name and a story, it actually changes our perspective because it's so much easier to be on one side of the world, as you said, and say, these people are this, we put them in boxes and labels and they don't have a name and they don't have a face.
Yep.
Interestingly, you said the coaching machine, and isn't it funny how at scale, people can then just talk about the numbers. Let's churn through the numbers. Let's send the 100 cold DMs. It's all generic. It's all the same. No one cares about the person.
Yeah. And here's my thing with coaching. Let's go back to the origin. Like what people actually associate coaching with is sports, right? Like that's To me, that's the original coaching. You know, like the greats, John Wooden, all, you mm-hmm. know, Ted Lasso. But so like, to me, it's like, if we think about what a sports coach does, it's supporting somebody and it's this mix of like strategy and then like making somebody perform. And to me, that's what coaching is. And that's all about the human. It's not about the numbers. It's not about this. And I think even coaches who focus on numbers, I've sold this much, I'm doing this much, it's such a disservice to the fact that like I get to serve and help humans.
Yeah. And you and I, coming from a business background too, it's like the numbers tell a picture, but they're not the whole picture. We see, I think in particular, the business coaching pyramid space, then it's an almost a fetishization around what your revenue is for the month without communicating the nuance and the subtlety with that. It's like, gosh, I was speaking to a friend yesterday, actually, you would know him. And anyway, the company he was working for last year, he said that they did about 1.4 million, but their take home was 70,000 after all their expenses. I was like, what on earth? That's poverty to me. In a very like simplistic way, there's a lot of stress and overwhelm for very little. And in that whole process, it's like, maybe the way in which things were structured were not conducive to them having a good lifestyle or enjoyment.
Yeah. Also, here's a couple of things I have to say about that. I mean, you and I have both seen this, is that people sometimes when they're talking about the money they made, they're talking about money that they've sold, which is actually just your projections. To me, the money I've made is money that's been deposited into my bank account. Which means it's also taken out the credit card fees, all this stuff. We're actually talking about a net number. And then you see people talking about this is my gross, but we're not talking about how much money they actually made because how much did I spend to make that? And three, there's two big things that I think we never talk about. Look at me. I'm waving my hand around. One is the lifetime value, the lifetime value of the customer. Because I can sell somebody something, but if I'm selling them snake oil, they're not coming back and perhaps they're canceling early. But like, what can I do to like create a long-term relationship? So maybe I'm not selling $1 million in a year, but I have a client who's paid me like, you know, I was just looking in my Stripe and it's like this top person has paid you like $50,000 or $60,000. And instead of setting that as a win, I see it as a responsibility. To like, what have I created for that person?
I love that you mentioned that. That is literally how I think about that new metric in the Stripe dashboard. You're saying, okay, mm-hmm. for those people who've, I mean, they've invested with you and at that level, they've been with you probably for a couple of years. And so there's longevity and there's loyalty there. And it's like, I almost feel the responsibility of continuing to earn someone's loyalty because I know that it's not owed. Like they don't owe me. Owe me that. You don't just willingly give your friends $50,000. How do you see that responsibility? Like what are some of the things or yeah, thoughts that you reflect on in terms of your coaching, your deliverability value that you
give to them? I think, you know, Ryan, I think it's interesting because we've both done Landmark that I think about integrity all the time. And like when people just give me money, I take it so seriously. Like I'm almost like scared of it because I'm like, whoa, like what am I don't know what to do with that. You know, like it feels, especially when I've had really big contracts, somebody's giving me $20,000, $40,000, $60,000 to build something for them. I want to over deliver. I want to make sure that they're winning. I want to make sure that I'm clear about what they have to do to win. And it goes into this idea. You know, I think it's really interesting to devalue. By, I mean, not assigning value, not actually devalue money, because like money is good. I've got my gold balloons that I made $1 million, da, da, da. Instead, like money is a tool. And if money is a tool, that's a tool that they've invested that I'm going to give them guidance. And I take that very seriously.
I think the record of your clients and what a low churn rate you have mm-hmm. if at all, like clients end up leaving you because they basically change path or do something completely different with their life. It's not because they're not getting value from your coaching anymore. And yeah. I think that hard to say for people, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that people leave for a variety of reasons. One, sometimes it's because they don't want to do the work. I do have people who go early and they're not, you know, I've had people be like, nothing changed. And I was like, what have you done? You know, but my, I'd say 80 to 85% of my clients have been around for years. And it's because it's a long-term relationship. I paint it as that. Like, we need this line item. If it's $10,000, $20,000 a year, we need to build it in. And like, I'm part of the team. I'm there making sure you're okay. We're going to build this together. And like, we have to set the expectation. The overnight millionaire is bullshit. Listen, like when I made, it took me a very long time to make $1 million. And it's not cheap to make $1 million. People are like, you're a millionaire? And I'm like, oh, hell no. I got to pay all these people. You know, like I had a team of, to do that, we were at 14, I think, at the thing. Like everybody has to get paid. And then I think the other thing is like, people stay with me because I'm honest. I'm not going to sell them. And I'll tell people if they have a bad idea. Why do you think? Why do people stay with you?
I honestly, for the same reasons, I think there's a duty of care that if someone has then chosen to invest with myself, then I'm being entrusted with something that they've worked very hard for. And I know how hard we've then worked for the money that we have. Sometimes I feel like those large ticket investment decisions, they're not always easy to make either. So for someone to then say yes, or even someone to say an easy yes, the reality is that they've had to pay a price to get to that point where that was then a yes for them. And if they're coming from somebody else where they've been burnt before, I also see that as a responsibility to help. I'm not responsible for their past experience, but I do take that into consideration because I understand that they're trusting again, and that's a big thing, and trying to work alongside that with people.
Yeah.
And being honest, for sure. I think seeing the person, coming back to your early point about them being the human in all of this as well, and recognizing that at the end of the day, it's not just a business interaction for me. It's that individual has a family, has relationships, has other things going on in their physical, mental, emotional health, well-being, and that their business is an extension of their life. I don't know many people at all who have completely been able to separate those two things. So I don't see that it exists in my world. I don't think that they exist in silos. And so having an appreciation for like what is being impacted in the business as a result of stuff happening outside of their business. And having compassion, empathy, understanding. But at the same time, they've also invested with us too to deliver. And sometimes that means like telling them the hard, honest truth that they don't get from anywhere else.
Wait, I have something else to say. Ryan, I think the reason that you and I keep clients is because you and I know a lot about business.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, this is like, this is a wild thing to say, but I have clients all the time be like, you really know a lot about this. And I'm like, you shouldn't pay somebody who doesn't know a lot about it.
That's very true.
Like that's wild. That's insane that people, that exists in the world. So I think like you and I both have like boots on the ground, corporate experience, investment experience, and entrepreneurial experience that allows us to really understand what's going to make a business run. Like the big thing I've been talking about, the thing I keep seeing people get into issues with is cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But like, if you don't understand that, if you're a business manifestation, come on. I just
that
said this.
Pay your bills for this month. Oh my gosh. One of the things that I've, it's so funny you say that because one of the things that I've also been teaching clients to do, like newer clients who've now, you know, moved to their accounting system and they're learning how to read their profit and loss statement for the first time, which is different from just seeing their Stripe notifications come through. And I'm like, okay, cool. How
Very
can
different.
You allocate money coming in to the different various programs, events, courses that you run? so that you know where you're spending and allocating your time. If something mm-hmm. is not very profitable, but you're spending 80% of your time building out this course that no one wants to buy, that's not a good use of your time.
Right.
And also painting the picture around cash flow. A couple of conversations I've been in recently have been around, you know, I want to create a low ticket membership thingy. And I said, great, what's your burn at the moment? And what's the shortfall? What do you need to generate? And they tell me, I said, unless you pulled a complete rabbit out of your ass and completely transformed your business, that low ticket thing that you launched this month ain't going to pay you.
I launched a membership when I had 17,000 people on my email list.
Wow.
Like, people have to understand when, because of cash flow. And also, you know, like, there's so much churn in memberships, which is great. Mm-hmm. Memberships are great, but they are not for, if you have less than 10,000 Instagram followers and you don't have a huge email list, you shouldn't do it. Because you're going to be chasing people and you're going to have four people paying you $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what's been getting right up my nose recently. Right up my nose is all the money manifestation stuff. Because people read, I'm just going to say it, people read the like rich as fuck. People read the like you're a badass at making money. Mindset is incredibly important because we can self-sabotage. But if you only read those books and you buy the Audi, you're going to go broke if you don't know how to manage your money.
1,000%.
You have to
also,
have.
Also, what I found really interesting, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Let's go here, because this is a conversation you and I haven't had offline yet. And I'm really curious, because I know that you, Lisa is in New York City. I mean, that whole entire network of people, we're like small fry. And I think that's in part what was attractive about being in the city, right? You're like nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And there's a hunger, there's a determination and a grit that, frankly, we don't have in Australia. That mm-hmm. American entrepreneurship, we don't have. And I think, like, it's very hard because environment can create that character in you. And we have so much comfort and safety over here that we don't have it. What I found interesting, because I read Rich as Fuck after you recommended it on your guest call to our mastermind, and I realized the author was doing like $3 million a year at the time.
And a lot of it at the time from real estate.
Right. Yes.
She's rich because of real estate. We need to say that.
Well, and I think that's really interesting because I think of $3 million as not a lot of money. Like, that's not going to get you very far mm-hmm. in New York.
No. And she's got a team. She's doing $3 million from her business, but she's making money because she's a real estate investor.
Right.
Yeah. So like, say the whole story. Sorry, I interrupted you.
I think that's really important. And so what I find really interesting about the terminology is how women and men speak very differently about money, because I'm in circles where no one's going to pat you on the back for having $3 million because they're like, well, that's not really much of a lifeline for your family. That's three properties. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not, it's not a lot. It's not a lot to guarantee your future. The estimates in Australia at the moment is that you need $3 million in your retirement account just to continue your average lifestyle for 20 years. Most people have 1/6 of what they anticipate is required. And so people's disillusion around not being able to manage their money is costing them a lot. And I guess I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is how women talk about numbers very differently to men. What I've found really interesting in this space at the moment, as you said, around mindset, there's the other thing that's popular is like shadow work in your business. And I think to myself, I'm like, men who are doing $10 or $20 million are not having business meetings about shadow work and their trauma. They're just getting the job done.
If I may, that's stupid. The shadow work stuff. That is, yes. You know, like, I work on things with a therapist. I do believe in energetic alignment, things like that. This is what yesterday I was teaching a money class as part of the membership. And I, one thing I talk about is planning, budgeting for the business you want, because people will budget and they'll budget small. But what I said was write your vision for 2024. I want to have this much. That is the art. We also need the science. The science is, how much is that going to cost me? Because people are like, I want to go from $5,000 a month to $25,000 a month. To five extra business is not going to be free. You occasionally people will trip over somebody who can do that, but it's either like you've hit on some sort of bubble or you're investing a lot of time. And so to me, we need the art and the science. And I do think that sometimes you find humans who are making $20 million a year and they maybe they need some shadow work because they're making $20 million a year and they're really fucking unhappy. But it's not part of the conversation on money. Like, they have mastered the science. To me, the shadow work, things like that, it is necessary, but it's not necessary to make the money. It's necessary to be happy.
Mm.
So to me, the actual magic is in the combination of the two. Yeah. But like, I mean, this is a Tony Robbins thing. If I walk out in my garden and there are weeds and I'm like, no more weeds, no more weeds. And I visualize it without weeds. I need to get on my hands and knees and do some hard work and pull the fucking weeds. And I need to get the benefit of appreciating myself from doing the hard work. That's how you de-weed your garden. That's how you make money, is you have to do the work and you have to understand the skill. And I think the thing with women,
cost, right? Because mm-hmm. I think,
because either
think
you're doing it.
Sorry, you go.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, because either you're doing it or you're paying somebody to do it.
And you might not want to incur that cost. And mm-hmm. I think what I'm trying to define with clients a lot at the moment, without vision, the people perish. It's like, you need to have such a compelling vision for your life and your business. I can't give that to you. And you've got to stop outsourcing it to people on the internet, because their life is not what you necessarily want, because they've also paid a high price to get it.
Yeah.
Number one. And number two is, you might not want to do all of that. So for someone to then have a $5 million a year business, for example, you might not want to have the team, or you might want to have a completely different business structure, but you want to be clear on what it is that you desire. You don't, if you understand your numbers and your cash flow, the life that you can live can be absolutely remarkable, and you can travel around the world and be in beautiful hotels. It just really depends on spending time crafting what life looks like for you, because otherwise people are going to dictate it to you and then tell you that you need, you know, maybe 10 times more than what you think you do, and create misery in the process of chasing it.
Yeah. And also, like, what does this mean, $1 million? Because for me, it means something different than you, because we work in two different currencies. $1 million here in Trinidad and Tobago is like, because it's $7 US. Like, what's the life you want? Why are we using these numbers? What does that mean? And I do have some, I had some goals about wanting to make seven figures, because, you know, it's like 1% of female owned businesses, but that was separate. Also, like, amount of money is a means goal. It's not an end goal. The end goal is, how do you want to feel? Money is a means to an end. The other thing I'm interested in is longevity. Like, for me, this will be the third year that my business has been in seven figures. I'm really interested in how to do that 5, 10 times, 20 times, because, like, this is the business that I'm creating that also supports all these other people that worked for me. Yeah. You see, you know, like, you and I have seen a lot of people sell that much money. I don't think anybody actually made that much money, and they're not doing it now.
Yes. And people who are around when you had your first year in seven figures aren't anymore, or they've switched, or they've changed, or they've realized, shit, I was selling the snake oil. Damn.
Yeah.
And they pivot and run away to try to escape the negative Google reviews.
Yeah.
Frankly, I don't know how people sleep at night trying to sell something that they can't deliver on, because that would...
That's wild. Yeah. The other thing I think about is, like, I think one thing for me is to realize that, like, businesses take time. I didn't hit near that number. We got really close with the dance studio for 12 years. Like, I think I also know it's going to take time and it's hard. I just want to go back to the thing about women.
Yes.
Because why do women talk about money differently? I want to say, I don't think that my gender, both my gender or my gender identity, both of which for me are the same, affect my ability to be skillful with money, because I've taught myself. I think what the world has told me about my ability with money makes women avoid it. And like being told to play small.
It's really interesting that you make that comment then. So because you've been in different groups and masterminds, you've worked with men and women, and you've been in different conversations, I imagine that some rooms that you now walk into as well, like you hold your own with the men anyway, and there's like a mutual respect. There's an understanding, like Lisa has her MBA. She can talk numbers. She can be down with the best of them. So coming back to that comment, because I find it really interesting then. So historically then, understanding that women's voices have been suppressed, they didn't work until 50 years ago. All of that. So now women are in the workforce. They have to understand numbers. You've got single mothers taking care of the family, managing money. We know statistically women are actually better at managing their money than men. It's a like thing that is well studied. And do you think that as the conversations have evolved, you know, the internet has democratized the ability to start a business, low cost, all these different things. What I find interesting is then, if you're in the same circle or the same echo chamber, then the opinions or the beliefs can then be, they can be dominant beliefs within that. So for example, if you have only a women's circle talking about money, you might adopt certain ideals or beliefs that are vastly different perhaps to what men in the business world have typically believed.
Mm-hmm.
What's been your kind of like observation? Because you're like part of the biggest BNI group, or you have been, at least in the past, in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say a couple of things. One that I think is really important is separating like pop psychology from things that actually have research behind them. Because the whole, and I do think that there's value in it, but I think it's deeply misinterpreted. The whole like masculine, feminine energy, da-da-da. Somebody made that up. And there is research that leans to some of that, but people have manipulated it. Now, there's studies, university studies that are, you know, like double, two people are checking it, all that kind of stuff, that not only are women better with managing money, that like when women are in charge, more people get taken care of. There's like books, there's a lot of university studies. You know, there's this whole thing like give a man a money and he buy $1 million, he buys a boat. Give a woman $1 million, the whole village is going to eat. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is both in the role of the mother and in the role of what we've learned in how to take care of ourselves. I was taught to take care of everyone. And this is obviously, this isn't everybody. And then the second thing I would think is, the rooms where people are talking about masculine and feminine energy are small money rooms. When I go to the big money rooms where there's people, men and women, who are making $5, $10, $20, $50 million a year running those companies, nobody's talking about male and female energy and being in and or out of it. People are talking about numbers. The conversation does come up there is what I would say is the dismissal of opinions from people who are female identified. You know, like there was this whole thing in the Obama administration where there was a rule among the women. If somebody said it, another woman would repeat it, and they studied it, and that idea was more likely to be heard.
Mm.
So like women speaking up more. And then there's also this big study on the like secret second job, which is that when women earner for the household, they're running a company, still typically that woman's doing more of the housework and raising the children.
Mm.
So those are the conversations I've heard at the large scale at the women who are working at big companies. But like, regardless of all that, I don't hear the conversation about like being your sacred feminine. Nobody who makes over $5 million a year, I've never heard them say that.
What I find really interesting, and you know, I've had these conversations too, perhaps, is like the maybe my own, which I can fully admit, is disillusionment about how the industry or how the space has then changed, perhaps. I think about this a lot, because if we then sell, you need to be in this energy, this vibe, this thing, you need to balance your core, have all your chakras aligned, etc., to make more money. The cap, as you just said, is only within a certain range. That yep. in itself for me is limiting, because cool, you move up the next bracket within a confined range, when in fact, often, and you and I both know this, multimillionaires under 3 to 5 million still feel absolutely broke.
Yeah, of course.
And statistically, a lot of them, the percentages, I believe, aren't much different from those earning less than 150,000. It's like there's statistically the similar amount of millionaires who still live paycheck to paycheck, which I find interesting. And then once you get into a completely different bracket of net worth, the way in which people think about money, the way in which people create their businesses, think about wealth building, as you mentioned before, longevity and sustainability in business. People plan in decades, not in days or months. Like, they're not thinking this yep. campaign launch just for November.
Yeah.
So I kind of find, I think for me, it's been interesting to start thinking a lot bigger in terms of what are the conversations that are happening. And a couple of months ago, I'm not sure if I shared this with you, I was on a plane back. I was flying back after doing some consulting for a client. And then the gentleman I sat next to, he was talking about him just doing a helicopter trip for 24 hours for a client of his who wanted to buy $600 million worth of land. And it was just said so casually, I'm so glad I sparked a conversation with him, because what I got appreciation for was that he was a dad and father figure and all of that. And the way in which he just spoke about $100 million property deals was that was his daily conversation. And in fact, funnily enough, he had a conversation with Emily's father about buying a farm a couple of years ago in our state. And I was just thinking, wow, so much of our conversations are so limiting in scope.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really powerful perspective shifter for me. Not that the money in and yeah. of itself mattered. It was just how people's realities can differ so much.
Yeah. And I think you have to choose that at some point. Like, I'm going to start, like, I was raised very middle class. I remember being like, I remember when my business shifted from hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars, like just in how people were paying me. And then at some point I was like, oh, it's time for tens of thousands. Like, I need to think in tens of thousands, because like, even, you know, today's the second, the first, I was like, how many tens of thousands of dollars did we bill in the first? Because that's not, we need it. I got to pay for everybody. Mm-hmm. And just to go back to the conversation, your conversation about feminine and masculine energy and gender identity and all that is great. It can be part of your identity. It can be part of your relationship. But here's my issue with making it part of your business. And this is my same issue with shadow work. It's about you. Businesses that make large scale amounts of money are about their client. So, like, who cares about my shadow? I care about what I can do for my clients.
Wow. I think you just really well articulated perhaps something that I couldn't, which was the overemphasis on pedestalizing the coach or the mentor. Mm-hmm. So then people buying into this trophy person and thinking, if I'm in that person's energy, vortex, space, mastermind, if I get proximity to talking with them for 20 minutes once a week on Voxer, then oh my gosh, my life's going to change, as opposed to empowering the individual. I find that really interesting.
The first time I ever saw the like gold balloons, I made $1 million or whatever. I was like, what bothers me about that? And I was like, oh, it's about you. My business is about my clients. the business, not even my business, because there are, you know, I talk about my business in we. There's 14 people who work there. We serve the clients.
I was going to say that that language has been an interesting evolution for myself as well. When the responsibility that you hold as well, when you've got your team, I'm not making decisions that are just solely for me anymore. And mm-hmm. I have a team who are better at plenty of things that I'm no good at. And so they'll help remind me, hey, we're making decisions as a team here. My evolution as a business owner has then also been in the past where I would like wing it and create it, a lot more thought and process and maturity, I think, in how I think about the longevity and the sustainability of things. Whereas perhaps the past, when you're just like racking up money and you're just operating like on your own, you can just whip things mm-hmm. out and create and all that kind of fanciful stuff. But there has to be this process and continuation. So my team's been really good at reminding me. And so I'm making decisions to accommodate them. And you got payroll. People still need to pay.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that will make you like change your mindset than being like, I got to pay other people. You know, what I'm excited about in personal development is the like centering of people who actually have a reason to be listened to. And the thing I think about the most, like, see, this is really interesting. The Hormozis, clearly it's a man and a woman. There's masculine and feminine energy. She's pretty feminine, but like, they don't talk about that. Like, that's small. And they're also not talking about, they're talking about themselves in terms of development, but they're never like, pick me. I'm the pretty one. I made $1 million, da, da, da. Like, I am so impressed with their integrity. But like, regardless, it's just exciting to see people who are being centered, who aren't just like full of shit.
Yeah,
and are making like real money.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Lisa, I'd love to know, what are you most excited about in terms of your business, and what's evolved for you around how you plan and how you've been thinking about your business since traveling? Because I can imagine that the energy and the spontaneity, and I know that you've like attributed so much fun and life to the last 7 months of travel. Has that impacted mm-hmm. your business strategy and planning for next year? What does that look like?
Yeah, the business was in the back seat a little bit, some. It was still in the car, but I'm very lucky that my business, I've created a business that can be in the back seat. It has moved back to the front seat. Like, I'm going to be here for 6 weeks and mm-hmm. I'm able to really refocus. And let's see, what I'm excited about is speaking. I'm starting to do a lot of like large scale speaking gigs, and I'm super, super excited about that. I'm excited about the staffing business because it's really creating a business that's not about me and the brand. And that's super cool. And I'm excited about some of the clients I'm getting. Like, I'm getting a lot of clients who are starting in the seven figures that we get to grow with. And that's exciting to me.
I love that. What would you say, what's the range of clients then you now serve, like top end? Because I could obviously problems at $100,000, $200,000 a year, $250,000 are very different to those at a mil, two and a half.
My private clients, I have say anywhere from like the mid six figures to 10 million.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Which one of those is like a legacy family business, which is like a whole other set of issues. One of them is a business that got purchased. One of them, so like, gets more interesting then. And then, you know, I've really been able to create these product lines, the evergreen courses, the membership that can still serve people in the low six figures, high five figures even, who can buy a course. But, you know, the thing is, when you start working with a client who's over 500, half a million, like, coaching is a line item and you get to dive more deep, because people aren't constantly thinking about, they're either spending their spouse's or their family's money on it, or they're not really there yet.
I think that's a massive difference as well. If you're not actually worried about paying the retainer or the fee, then you just remove all of that angst and the pressure, and the relationship changes, because now you're not the enemy and the the pressure isn't on you as the savior of the business. I think that's definitely mm-hmm. something that I've learned, where perhaps I either misread the client or I've been misinformed, because I'd never want to put a client under financial pressure to work with me. But if mm-hmm. they've taken on board that decision and I haven't known the full story, then I think it's hard. And in the past, I probably would have said I would want to overcompensate or try to bend, certainly in early parts of my business, try to like give extra of myself as value when I don't really see that I need to do that. And
yeah, it's super interesting to work with a client who's making $1 to $10 million a year. It's the exact same amount of effort from me, and it's different problems, but like I actually find that they don't need more because they're busy.
It's in a harmonious relationship. What I've really reflected on, because you mentioned that you have these long-term clients too, that in long-term relationships, you don't have all this anxiety attached with the pressure or like the need to have it done tomorrow. Basically, a really activated nervous system where it's frenetic energy, and you can feel that in the dynamic of the coaching. When you really settle into the relationship and you recognize, oh, Lisa's not dramatic. Like, it's calm.
Yeah.
She's on your team. Mm-hmm. It's there. It's so different and it's so beautiful.
Yeah. And I think also like setting that expectation up front, I'm like, listen, you're not going to see changes immediately. You know, like I recently had a client who's like a large scale maker, they're a craftsperson. And we really realized that they needed to just switch from doing consumer facing sales to going to all wholesale and then redoing the projections, because the margin is much smaller, but you're doing it at scale. And, you know, like very clearly, I was like, you got to give me a year. And in 6 months, we've seen a huge change and just wow. had the biggest month in business. Amazing. But like, you have to understand what you're trying to do. Yeah.
It's actually not a 4-week program. Perhaps what I observe and what I find interesting is this: you're in a freaking candy store and you're like, let me buy this 4-week injection into my business and let me buy this 2-month thing and then this 2-week accelerator program, and trying to piecemeal stuff together into mm-hmm. one's business without understanding, hold on a moment, actually to make this sustainable so that you're not fully stressed out either in the process, it does take time. And
yeah.
moving from the micro view of, shit, I need to solve cash flow in November and December, to, hey, I need to solve cash flow forevermore in my business. And that type of thinking means you actually have to consider different things altogether, different inputs, different outputs. Moving to a wholesale model, of course it takes time. There's no way that you could like model that out effectively in 3 weeks and then hope for the best. So I find that really kind of fascinating, how some business owners might just run on the adrenaline of trying to like frantically do one thing, implement, do this next thing. And it's like running on the hamster wheel a lot of the time and pursuing shiny object syndrome, which I think is very much a thing that occurs at the early stages of business. I know I certainly did that and spent 3 mm-hmm. hours trying to pick the color of some button on the website and then realize that it didn't matter. But the evolution in business perhaps is playing a longer game.
I think it's a longer game, and realizing that like if you put yourself in a position to not feel desperate, you're going to build a good business. So like, you know what I tell people? Get a loan. You know, if I was going to open a restaurant, I would get a business loan. The repayment gets put in a line item in the budget. You're working with the coach to do contracts. So like, get a loan.
I love that. Is there anything else that you've been thinking of that's not directly related to business, but has made a profound impact on your life?
I think that like we were talking about this at the beginning of the call. You know, I'm your social justice friend. I'm always like, about something. But profound amounts of privilege. That's what I've been thinking about. Like to be traveling the world with American dollars and an American passport which, you know, we're not the most loved country at the moment, but like the amount of privilege that gets me and the amount that I get with this money is wild. And I didn't do anything to get that. People can shut the front door about, well, you, I didn't do anything. I see people here in the Middle East, and I mean, in some parts of the Middle East, some parts of the Middle East are way wealthier. You know, the most stable currency in the world is Kuwaiti. Is like my privilege is palpable. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this? How am I going to help? How am I going to get involved? Because it is not about money. Like we said, money's a tool. It's about you being a human in the world.
I love that. One of the things I've been really sitting in is if you have privilege, the capitalistic part in me is then I say use it, because it's a darn shame to not use it and like feel sorry for yourself that you've got it and punish yourself and move yourself in guilt and shame and all this kind of stuff. So you're ineffective, because as soon as you move into that space, then in part you don't have a voice and you can't be useful because you're dealing with your own stuff again. Mm-hmm. And so then we play small. But if you recognize that, wow, you've got a superpower, you've got a voice, you've got a platform. I'm still amazed how this chocolate candy bar sized device that we can hold in our hand allows us to reach 3 billion people, learning how to use it and maximize it as best we can to make a difference, make an impact, get ourselves ahead where we can without compromising our values and beliefs in the process. But yeah, otherwise it goes to waste.
It goes to waste. Yeah, I 100% use it. And I think that, like, because, you know, like nobody wants you to feel sorry for them. And I actually think the guilt is privilege. The time to feel guilt and shame is privilege. So use it. And then, like, you know, I think you've seen me post that. I'm not allowed to post anything on social media about a cause unless I also send money.
Yes.
Because, like, honestly, like, with my followers and base, I'm preaching to the choir. So, like, use the privilege and then use that money to do something.
Guys, for those listening, the one thing that I absolutely love about chatting to Lisa all the time, and I've had the pleasure of speaking with her mastermind and with her group of clients before, one of the things I absolutely love about you is the diversity in your client base, which gives you, and you basically have like so much perspective on issues and the world being in the melting pot that is New York City too. I love the diversity, and I think the difference is that if you then just surround yourself with people who look and talk the same way as you too, then you miss out on a lot of learning, a lot of appreciation, a lot of empathy and understanding for other people who also just...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think the reason that I have a diverse client base is because I speak up. You know, like, people feel safe. People know that I'm going to acknowledge my own privilege. Even, you know, somebody was like, on your podcast, you had a woman from Saudi Arabia. I know you're not going to be, I mean, for a variety of reasons, I hope people would know this, but, like, you know, she's Muslim. She's like, I know you're not going to be Islamophobic. You're going to understand certain things. So, like, the bigger, also, like, forget money, forget this. Like, the bigger my circle, the more beautiful my world. You know, I got to go iguana hunting with a bunch of like teenage boys here, you know, because I'm friends with their soccer coach, and that's fucking living. That's connecting with humans. And like to see 17-year-old boys, you know, in the West, 17-year-old boys are like, won't even drive a car because they're scared. These boys can like fend for themselves and feed themselves and have like really amazing thoughts about it, and like are telling me the history of this island. And I'm like, we need to learn from them.
Was the iguana tasty? That's what I want to know.
It's good. I actually liked it. It was kind of like chicken. You know, like, you know, it was stewed. So it was in a, but they were all like, you're going to eat it? And I was like, yeah, I'll eat an iguana. But it's, you know, it's considered a hate pigeon in Egypt. I mean, pigeons a delicacy in Egypt. Like, this is my lesson from the last 6 months. Do the thing. Swim in the ocean. Eat the iguana. Hunt the iguana. Like, I don't have to be posting on Instagram all the time. Go hunt the iguana.
I love that. Oh, amazing. Yeah. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your time. I just love our conversation so much. We could go for hours and hours. So just appreciate you and the beautiful view that you shared with us too. And
thanks. Here, let's look at it.
On the world. It's stunning. So for those of you listening, Lisa just has this beautiful view. Is that like the rainforest?
It's the rainforest. So I'm in a hill in a town called Betel in Tobago, which is Tobago is part of Trinidad and Tobago, which is one country. Trinidad is large. Tobago is small. It's about 70,000 people. And I'm looking over the palm trees and the like. It's so lush onto the, this is, so the Atlantic's on that side and this is the Caribbean Sea. And it's amazing. What a privilege that these people share their world with me.
What a gift that you've built a business and life that you love to be able to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for sharing your wisdom with us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ryan.
That's it, folks. Another amazing episode of Limitless with Lisa Z. I am inspired and want to give you the homework. Take some notes, take action, do one thing today that can move you towards your dreams. Got feedback? Let us know. You can write to us at lisa@lisazahia.com or visit us online at lisazahia.com.